A Time of Love and Tartan, a 44 Scotland Street novel by Alexander McCall Smith, read by David Rintoul. When Pat McGregor received an invitation from Bruce Anderson to meet him for coffee at the Elephant House on George IV Bridge, her first reaction was to delete it. That is one of the great advantages of electronic communications. One can simply delete them. And one can do the same to people, in their electronic incarnation, of course. At the press of a button, or the equivalent, one can send them off into some vast soup of disassembled digital data, reducing them to floating ones and zeros, consigned to a Dantean world of echoes, a shadowy underworld of fading impulses. And that, thought Pat, was the fate that Bruce so richly deserved. A few years earlier, he had played with her affections, as he had toyed with those of so many other young women, believing that to pay attention to this rather shy young student of art history was to confer on her a benison for which, if she knew anything about the world, she should be profoundly grateful. The expression, God's gift to women, came into all this somewhere. It was usually uttered sarcastically, as in, he thinks he's God's gift to women, but in Bruce's case, this was exactly what he did think of himself. In his view, he was one of those people who existed to give pleasure to others, not through anything he actually did, although that, of course, entered into it, but simply by being. Auden said that the blessed had no reason to care from what angle they were regarded, having nothing to hide. This was true of Bruce. Whether you looked at him from the front, the back, or from either side, the inescapable conclusion was that he was egregiously good-looking. As he pointed out to Katrina, a young woman with whom he once visited Florence, "There's a statue of my double in this city, you know?" She had looked puzzled. "Your double, Bruce? Here in Florence?" Bruce smirked. "Yes, right here. Would you like to see it?" She nodded. This was some sort of game, she suspected. But then Bruce was so playful. That was one of the things that attracted her to him, his playfulness. That, and of course the way he made a girl feel special. Now that was a very considerable talent. And then there was his hair gel, that strange clove-scented potion that tickled her nose when she smelt it, and added in such a curious way an erotic charge to the most mundane of situations. Bruce and Katrina had already visited the Uffizi, and had stood for some minutes before Botticelli's Birth of Venus, before Bruce said, "That's Venus, you know. That's her standing in the shell." Katrina nodded. "She's very beautiful, isn't she?" Bruce thought about this for a few moments before he replied, "Her neck's a bit long, but yes, she's beautiful, all right." Then, after a short pause, he had observed, "Beauty's an interesting thing, isn't it? You either have it or you don't, and that's all there is to it." Katrina looked at Bruce. He returned her gaze with all the confidence of one who knew that he stood on the right side of the divide he had just described. That was in the Uffizi. Now they found themselves in the Galleria dell'Accademia, looking up at Michelangelo's great masterpiece, the towering statue of David.
"There," said Bruce, "feast your eyes on that."
The contemplation of Michelangelo's David is not easy for everybody, but Katrina looked.
"Look alike," whispered Bruce.
She stared at the line of David's nose and brow. It was undoubtedly Bruce. Her eye followed the sweep of his arms and the musculature of his torso, and she had to admit it. Bruce could have been Michelangelo's young model.
"I don't tell everybody about this," confided Bruce, "but I remember when I first saw a photograph of David, I thought, jeez, that's me. I was about 16 at the time, in Crieff. I was in Morrison's, you know, and one of the girls in the class stuck a picture of David up in a corridor and wrote underneath it, 'Bruce Anderson.' It was so immature, but somehow..."
Pat, of course, had soon detected Bruce's narcissism. But in her state of infatuation, for that, she acknowledged, was what it was, she had persuaded herself that his self-obsession was a harmless quirk, a hangover from adolescence, a passing phase. After all, there were plenty of young females who were just as fascinated by their appearance, spending hours in front of the mirror. It was more unusual amongst males, perhaps, but what was sauce for the goose should surely be sauce for the gander. If women were to indulge themselves in the contemplation of their own beauty, then why should men not do the same?